Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts.
And we are delighted today to be joined by Craig Brown. Craig is an award-winning satirist, critic, author, columnist and former restaurant reviewer. His most recent book, 1, 2, 3, 4, The Beatles in Time, won the Bailey Gifford Prize for nonfiction. Craig, welcome to Table Talk.
Well, it's very nice to be here.
Craig, we're going to start where we always do, at the beginning, and ask you, what are your earliest memories of food?
I think my earliest memories of food are all to do with unpleasant food. But that's maybe the nature of memory, in that you remember your school days much more than your sort of happy holidays. And so I think my earliest memory of food is I was at a convent school. I suppose that was primary school. And we were made to eat pork. You know the horrid jelly that comes with pork pies? I mean, now I don't have to eat it. That's a great thing about being grown up. You can choose what you want. But I remember feeling really sick every time. And my mother had to send a postcard to the Reverend Mother saying, please let Craig off eating pork pies, because otherwise they just made you sit there and eat it. And anyway, so I was then allowed off eating the jelly and pork pies. And then I also have a vivid memory of the day that I realized that tongue, which I had up to then enjoyed, and people used to eat tongue in those days, I don't think they do now, but I realized that tongue meant tongue, that it wasn't just a kind of coincidence of the names. And I remember we were at a hotel, Acton's Hotel in Kinsale. Well, I cut into a slice of tongue and then I suddenly saw a vein. And at that moment, it dawned on me that tongue meant tongue. So I've never been able to eat tongue since then. Mind you don't get it served, really, do you, in restaurants? They don't say, would you like some tongue? And yeah, so those are my most vivid memories, really things that I didn't like.
And when you were at home, what were mealtimes like?
We'd have that sort of normal, this was all in the 60s, I suppose, sort of normal kind of grey lamb or grey beef or shepherd's pie. So we'd always say grace. You'd always say, thank you, God, for a lovely lunch. Please may I get down, all in one in one sentence without punctuation. And we did have sort of some eccentric tastes. I mean, I was a family of six children. One of the things we'd have for tea, which does seem very peculiar now, was Weetabix with butter on and raspberry jam.
We used to have that.
Did you? Oh, that's reassuring.
We did. We had it for breakfast rather than tea, but my sister and I used to have that. We also...
Oh, no, I suppose the Weetabix is... But, yes, it seems in a funny way more like kind of... Weetabix then becomes toast in a way.
Do you have it with milk as well, or just... Do you have anything to kind of moisten it, or is the butter doing the job there?
Yeah, and the jam. I mean, yeah, it'd be very hard for just a dry... My brothers actually used to eat Farley's rusks until they were quite old. And I still sheepishly buy Kellogg's variety packs, you know, and I realise it's not sophisticated or anything. I do like the variety, though now they've cut down, just in the, no one's written, someone should do an angry column in the Spectator, because they've cut down on the, there used to be two packets of Frosties in a variety pack, and now there's only one, and they've snuck that through, and no one's mentioned it.
A Frosty's your favourite cereal in the variety
pack? Well,
they're
everyone's favourite. You don't want just normal cornflakes. And then there's a new variety of sort of Rice Krispies, I can't remember what they're called, which just, you know, they pretend that they're healthy, but they obviously aren't. And they put those in instead of the Frosties. Anyway, these are issues sent to try us.
We will let Rod Little know. I'm sure that's the subject.
And is it uniformly awful memories of childhood food apart from the Weetabix? Or was there anything that you look back on fondly?
No, because obviously those constant memories, like, you know, I always really like shepherd's pie, anything with tomato ketchup. And so they were on constant supply. So it'd be awful to think that I had a sort of Dickensian childhood where I had the jelly off pork pies. I think I wasn't that interested in food, and I was very skinny until I was about, you know, 22 or something. I don't remember really looking forward to meals or anything. At my prep school, there was a Scout troop, the 23rd Basingstoke Scout Troop, and on Sundays. And so we'd then start cooking for ourselves. I do remember once we were cooking at sort of night time, and it was only after we'd eaten the sort of sausages and baked beans all mixed together, which is the only thing you can cook over a fire. Maybe it was the next day, but we realized that someone had cut himself very, very badly. So we'd all been eating his blood all over our baked beans. in the dusk, the tomato sauce of baked beans looks rather like blood.
That might be the most horrific thing we've heard on this podcast. We've heard some bad things. You were at Eton, Craig. What was food like there? I imagine, I guess, in the 70s.
At Eton, it was, at least then, it was all per house. So each house of about 50 people had its own kind of dining room. And our house really had disgusting food. I'll tell you what was horrid was Spam fritters. I bet you haven't had Spam fritters, but you probably never had Spam, have you?
I've had Spam fritters, but that's because I grew up in Sunderland.
Yeah. They're very fashionable in Sunderland. Yeah, so Spam fritters. And also they did this, I always like Heinz baked beans, not Cross and Blackall, which is sort of darker and nastier. But they'd serve these baked beans, but they'd cut up raw onion to kind of, I suppose, to sort of doll it up a bit, but you had these slices of raw onion in with the baked beans. That was really horrid. And so I remember, but as I was saying, I wasn't that interested in food in those days, so it didn't particularly bother me. And you could also go to the shops and get kind of, you know, fish and chips and things if you had the money. Yeah, so people used to get chips a lot. I suppose tuck, as it was called at my prep school at least, was a big thing, sort of. On Sundays, you're allowed a chocolate bar or that kind of thing. And the sophisticated boys had Toblerone, which I never really liked. And I still don't really.
And did your family go to restaurants when you were younger? Was that something? I mean, it's obviously a much more common occurrence nowadays, but was it something that your family did then?
We did a bit, with sort of every now and then. I suppose not when we were very small. It would have been a kind of waste of time. I remember the first one I used to go to actually were with a friend from prep school in the holidays. We'd go to a Wimpy Bar, which were a kind of early version of McDonald's, the first sort of burgers you could get. And I have a very happy memory of Wimpy Bars. But then with my parents, we'd go to, I was sort of living in the home counties, and we'd go to sort of restaurants with sort of very, very heavy leather menus, and that sort of probably in French. And certainly on holiday, yeah, if we went on holiday, sometimes we'd go to Acton's Hotel where I had my terrifying tongue experience. Yeah, so you'd always have, on holidays, you'd go to the hotel restaurant. So I suppose your palate, your sense of what was edible should have been broadened by then. But I think we were stuck to the tried and tested things. So the nearest things like roast chicken to what we'd get at home.
And tell us about the early days of your career when you were starting out as a journalist. What was food like then? Were you eating out a lot?
I did. I mean, not quite soon, but I became around the age of about 30, I suppose, I became a restaurant critic with the Sunday Times. And so that was very nice. They wanted someone. It's now become rather kind of normal, but in those days, if there were, the few restaurant critics there were all very serious, sort of po-faced, and wrote as if they were writing an exam paper. It's slightly unfair. There were one or two exceptions like Quentin Crewe. And I think they certainly didn't say, are you interested in food? They just thought they needed someone to describe the experience of being in a restaurant, which food is quite marginal to the restaurant experience in a way. I certainly made it marginal. I found there's such a limited vocabulary for actually describing taste. I certainly had a limited, you know, you'd say tasty or very tasty or delicious, and that was about it. So I'd always leave that to the very last paragraph, and the other 1,000 words or 1,200 words, it would all be about, you know, the way it was decorated or the other people eating or, you know, just general. Or I might talk about pork pies or something like that. You know, so they were sort of chatty pieces.
And what are your kind of main memories of restaurants during that time? I'm guessing that's sort of the 80s and early 90s, is that correct?
Yeah, I'd say, well, I mean, I did it maybe 10 years, because then I did the Sunday Times and then the Sunday Telegraph. Yeah, for about 10 years. The odd thing was, you know, because you had to do a different one every week. And sometimes, because I lived in the country, I'd sometimes go to London and then eat sort of, once I had four meals in a day. So I reviewed a breakfast, a lunch, a tea and a supper. Just so I, then that would give me a month's worth. and you're always, breakfast is a tricky one to review because basically all breakfasts are the same, aren't they? It's a very small sort of palate, you know, bacon and sausage and that kind of thing. But I do remember one restaurant in Knightsbridge, I was having breakfast, slightly thinking, oh my God, you know, how am I going to fill the 1,000 words? And suddenly the kitchen caught on fire. So, and I thought, this is great, you know, this is at least 700 words. And so, the you know, as my father-in-law is a journalist, you say, God always provides. There's always something to write about. I did notice when I stopped doing restaurants, I didn't sort of, you get so used to reviewing a new restaurant, everything is a new restaurant. And when I start reviewing them, I just went back to the ones that I'd always gone to before I started reviewing. And I didn't have a further interest in seeing, you know, the exciting new restaurant, which has just opened. And I still don't really. I prefer to go places that I already know about.
Which are your old favourites? Obviously, everything's probably closed at the moment, but...
Well, actually, now I'm going to have to contradict my... I like big, bustling restaurants with lots going on, as long as they're, you know, efficient. I used to like Kensington Place. I don't even know if it's still going. Or Delaunay's in the Old, which I think is really good, because it's, you know, you get a sort of sense of glamour there and it's large and bustling. The food is kind of average. It's probably okay. But as I was saying before, I don't think food is central to restaurants. I live in Suffolk most of the time. And so in Aldborough, where I live, you know, there are lots of good restaurants and dependable. And so, yeah. So I sort of stick to the tried and tested, I think.
And what about when you're at home? Are you a dab hand in the kitchen?
I'm not bad at about half the things you should be good at. I'm pretty good at. I cooked a very good risotto at lunchtime today. I'm good at risotto. I like those ones where you don't have to panic about time. You know, like they do on MasterChef. You know, it's always... cooks, you have 5 minutes. You think, why put yourself through this sort of strain? I mean, some people do panic at risotto, but as long as you sort of prepare it all before and cut your courgettes, whatever you're having, into little pieces before, then it's kind of relaxing. And stews and sort of shepherd's pie, that kind of thing. Things which it doesn't really matter if you are 20 minutes late with, or, you know, you can just keep warm. But what I can't do is I can't do baking. Maybe it was at the beginning of lockdown, I thought, well, I better start trying, you know, before I die, I better have baked a cake. And I tried, I might have chosen the wrong one. Someone said, well, lemon drizzle cake is easy. But for some reason, it didn't work at all. And I thought maybe the holes created by the lemon had sort of taken the air out. You're meant to get lots of air into baking, aren't you? It was more like a biscuit. I haven't bothered, because it's so easy. There's actually a very good baker, and I don't particularly like cake either. So, and what else? Yeah, so I'm good at all that. Otherwise, you know, you have sort of fry ups and, you know, lamb chops and things like that. I'm not really a gourmet. I mean, I like it. I prefer delicious food to average food, and obviously, I prefer average food to disgusting food. But it wouldn't bother me. If someone said you can never go to a kind of really grand restaurant ever again, it wouldn't particularly upset me, I don't.
And what about when you're writing? Do you have certain foods and drinks that you like to have whilst you're writing?
Yes, I tend to write in the mornings, and by 12, I hope I'm getting to the end. Well, I almost always am getting to the end of whatever piece I'm writing. And so at 12, I treat myself to a glass of wine. And that sort of helps with the sort of downward slide. Or is it? It should be up. It should make it improve rather than get coherent. Anyway, it just
you know, so it's a little kind of reward for getting that far. And then just, so anyway, that's all I have. And then obviously coffee at the beginning, but you can, luckily I'm now right on another floor from the kitchen, because otherwise you can go mad making yourself coffee just because you can't be asked to write the next paragraph. And I don't particularly like coffee. Sometimes I have, this is probably going back to sort of infantilist, but recently when I got fed up with coffee, I have Marmite with hot water, you know, a spoonful of Marmite. I suppose it's like Bovril.
Like Bovril.
Yeah.
But I have Marmite with hot water. And actually it's actually nicer than coffee, I think. They'd be a bit disgusting to have it all day. I don't have, after breakfast, I don't sort of eat crisps or anything. I don't really snack before lunch. And then I tend to pick out at lunch. We usually have soup for dinner, sort of watching the telly. So soup, so I sort of pig out at lunchtime, and then and I'm not that hungry, or even, I don't really like, I like drinking at lunchtime, and I don't really like drinking in the evening, which is handy, otherwise I'd be a complete alcoholic, just half an alcoholic.
And do you find you can write after you've had a drink, or once you've had the drink, is that sort of, that's that?
No, because I'm still, say I'm doing 750 words, I'd hope to have got to about 650 by 12 o'clock. And then I think it's quite good to sort of just, I mean, it does, a glass of wine makes absolutely no difference. But I suppose if I had three glasses, then the writing would, I don't suppose the writing would get worse. It would just take longer to do. And that I think I'm quite a good kind of critic of my own writing. And I don't think I'd let myself, I don't think I'd be more lenient with myself if I had too much to drink. I don't know.
And back in the day when we were allowed to go to things, do you have sort of fun memories of lots of journalistic parties and trips to the pub and that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, certainly when I've never really worked in an office. I did work on Tatler, sort of, I think it was 8 days a month I had a kind of contract with. So, and then I'd spend most of the time, I mean, working on those kind of magazines is, you basically don't have to work. I don't know why everyone bothered. They should have just gone in sort of 2 days before the deadline. That's what, and so there was a lot of free time. So I get in at, this is Condé Nast with Tatler, I get in at say 10 o'clock, which is when you're meant to get in, and start planning where I was going to have lunch at 11:30, and then have lunch often until about 3 o'clock, and then go home at 5. You know, and nowadays I guess in Condé Nast everyone just has sandwiches and looks virtuous. And the Sunday Times, certainly when I was on it in the sort of, I suppose, the late 70s, early 80s, unbelievable drinking culture, really, which I certainly participated in, so I don't want to be priggish about it. And, you know, my father-in-law was on the Daily Telegraph in those days, as he was deputy editor. And they would certainly have, you know, a bottle of wine each over lunch and then write the editorial. I mean, most of Fleet Street, or what used to be Fleet Street, is dry now. I don't know whether the Spectator is or not. It doesn't read as if it is.
There's a fair amount of booze, I'd say.
I was going to ask about puddings, because you said you're not a fan of cake. Do you have a sweet tooth, or can you just forego all of that?
I'll tell you what I like is Bendix Bitumens.
Oh.
I'm not very puritanical. I don't like it when people have two. I think one is exactly right, and the two is just slightly sort of sickly. And so I like Bendix Bitumens. I don't really care about ice cream or anything, or chocolate. I wouldn't mind if I never had chocolate again, really. I think actually, and I don't know why restaurants don't do it, what you want is a nice fruit salad or something at the end of a meal. And all these things like, you know, you get in pubs, banoffee pie, absolutely disgusting. And so I think I don't probably have a sweet tooth. Or if I did, I'd want it at the beginning of the meal. I mean, by the end of the meal, if you've had sort of steak or something, the idea of then having something really rich, I don't understand why people do that. Well, my wife does very nice kind of sliced oranges in Pimm's. That's very nice.
That sounds delicious.
Yeah.
And obviously, we're recording this in the third lockdown. Apart from the cakes, what have you been sort of enjoying or turning to during lockdown? in the sort of culinary sense.
When my daughter and her boyfriend are allowed to be here, they're both vegetarian. And maybe because they're vegetarian, they're both very good cooks. So if I was that kind of good cook, I could see the point of being vegetarian, because it's probably nicer than just slabs of meat. Yeah, so, you know, recently I had a thing I would thought was horrid in the old days, but cauliflower curry. Well, it was really good, really delicious. I mean, I think coconut milk I must start experimenting with, because it seems to, I suppose it's like cream, turns everything nice. Stew with cream, it's always somehow nice. And I suppose coconut milk is the same. Yeah, so that's something I've discovered in the last year, that you can actually have nice vegetarian food. Otherwise, Aldbury's very good for fish. There are fishermen's huts which sell the fish, and there's the Aldbury market which sells fish. And so and my wife's very good at cooking fish. So we have quite a lot of cod and smoked salmon and salmon itself and that kind of thing. I quite like white bait, actually, in restaurants. I've never cooked it at home. I like the kind of quantity. Like, it is a bit like, if you're feeling gloomy, it is a kind of genocide, isn't it? Accusingly at you as you put them into your mouth.
And finally, Craig, what would be your desert island meal?
That's funny, because I was thinking, well, perhaps you'd ask me, this might be my just depressive frame of mind at the moment, but I thought you might say, what would be your meal if you're going to be executed the next day, like they give you in Texas?
Yes, we tend to go for desert island.
Same concept.
Yeah, but, I don't know, a lot of spectator contributors I can imagine on death row one day. So I was going to say sort of 500 mile sausage, so you keep saying, I haven't quite finished yet. But like Scheherazade saying. But I suppose I do think risotto is just very kind of relaxing both to cook and it's delicious to eat. And the danger with risotto, like shepherd's pie, is that your stomach doesn't have any kind of warning siren saying, I've had enough. You only realize you've had too much when it's too late, because it sort of slips down too easily. Yeah. So I think my desert island would be risotto. I certainly wouldn't have a tasting menu. I find them kind of annoying. You know, just have one bite of something and then having to keep saying thank you to the waiter every time doing something.
And would you have pudding? Would you have a fruit salad? Or
yes, it's funny because I don't think of myself as a particularly fruit person, but actually, because I don't really like, I used to like brandy. I used to be able to make brandy snaps actually as a child. I could make scones and brandy snaps. You know, under the age of 10. I was doing them, but I got no idea how you make them. I must have done it from a recipe book. But I can imagine liking a brandy, if you want a sort of slightly disgusting thing, a brandy snap stuffed with cream might be rather tasty.
Mm. Delicious. And presumably a Benedict's bitterment to finish things off.
Yes, that would be very nice. But I think actually it'd have to be either or. And I on a desert island, unless it was a chilly desert island or it was in winter, Benedict's bitterments would probably melt.
Craig, thank you very much for joining Table Talk.
Thank you for joining us on the Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website.
And if you've enjoyed the podcast, please do subscribe. And if you've really enjoyed it, please do leave us a star rating and review. It really helps us out.